Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Mechanic and Mr. Machine.
Last week, we were in a neck of the woods, familiar to me from my childhood, and tonight, we're headed down to Scott's stomping grounds in the Carolinas, the Kakalakis, to one of those old family houses that everybody related to it has a story about, and nobody fully agrees on. You know the kind. Deep front porch, slate roof, the paint's so thick you can't see the joints of the wood anymore. And are we talking about a screened-in porch, Scott?
Well, and it certainly could be, but not necessarily in this story, but certainly in plenty of houses in my life, in history, in my family's history.
Well, you need to, right, if you want to sleep on the porch and not get devoured by mosquitoes.
Yeah, it just depends Skeeters. On where you are, especially okay. The low country or near it, which is where tonight's story is actually taking us. I'll step in here for people who don't know my home state of North Carolina.
Oh.
Picture it geographically as three kind of long bands running mm-hmm. from the southwest to the northeast in a way that we have the mountains in the west, one of the oldest ranges in the country, and I think possibly the world, the Appalachians, which is why they're so much smaller than the Rockies. The Rockies are much more prominent,
yeah,
but that's because they're just kids compared to the Appalachians.
That's right. They're worn down. That's one thing I remembered in my college geology class is that you can tell the age because it's kind of worn down.
That's right.
Rounded, and the newer mountain formations will be jagged. And think
that's
about
right.
that waterfall that's in Prometheus, the film.
Oh, yes.
And people are wondering, is that AI? Is that, what is that? Is that CG? It looks so rugged, it doesn't look real. Apparently, that's in Iceland.
I think it's Norway, or Iceland, yeah.
And it looks like that because it's new, relatively, you know, as the Earth. So it's not worn down yet, but... Yeah, beautiful country there. So you're okay. So we have the Piedmont area, which have you been to much in the stomping around up there?
Well, the Piedmont, yes, I've been to it quite frequently, and I'm sitting in it right now.
Oh.
The Piedmont is the middle part of the state.
Okay.
So you got the mountains on the far west, and
right.
then the Piedmont is the middle part.
Okay.
And then there's the coastal plain, which is where you get to when you start maybe driving down towards the beach. That's flat, sandy, low country that runs all the way out to the ocean. But where the Piedmont and the plain meet, the coastal plain, there's a seam, which geologists call the fall line.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all the rivers going down, the Haw River, all these amazing, beautiful rivers, they drop off of hard rock and onto soft sand as you get to this sort of in-between country or the sand hills.
Yeah.
Not the coast, not the hills, a little of both and fully neither.
A sandy hill crane threshold kind of, right?
That's basically? Right. That's right. A little bit of a shout out there. But that's the word for it. And these are... old families and old houses, a lot of them a century or more ago when the rail and the mills came through, clapboard, hand-built, added on to generation after generation, held together with a lot of duct tape and other,
chicken wire,
fire hazards, yes. Right. And but it's the kind of place where four or five lifetimes have stacked up under one roof. You're far enough inland that you know the beach isn't too far away, but it still feels distant right up until the season turns and the storms start coming in off the ocean. They can make their way pretty far inland and be pretty deadly, the hurricanes anyway. Yeah. My own family actually once lived in a house in this part of the state, famously known as the House in the Horseshoe.
Yes, I remember you talking about that. Yeah. And there's something to do with the color of the paint?
No, that's actually my great-grandparents' house in Boylan Heights in Raleigh, say of the Connells album, famous name. But
right.
Yeah, they had a house with a haint-colored roof on the porch.
Keep away spirits, right? Bad
yes,
spirits.
Yes, but this house, the House in the Horseshoe, is a whole different story. It does not have a porch. It's a much older house and a more detailed story. Google it. It'll come right up. Just look up House in the Horseshoe. I don't even think you have to put North Carolina. You can read about it.
I know that's another story, but wasn't there something paranormal connected to the Horseshoe House? House in the Horseshoe?
Yes. War hospital, blood on the walls that no amount of paint will make go away.
Got it. That's enough. Yeah. That'll just...
My great-grandmother lived there for some time. So anyway, here's the thing that makes tonight's dead letter from our listener, Dean, sit with me. This isn't a story about a believer trying to convince you of anything. It's the opposite. It actually comes from a little bit of a skeptic. Mm. Somebody who spent years certain his family had it wrong, that the house in question was just a house. This is the account of how a place can slowly and patiently change a person's mind without ever, raising its voice, so to speak. Forrest, take us through the front door.
My grandmother's house is a strange place. For your mental image, picture old Victorian house, clapboard, slate roof, flanked on each end with rounded off bay rooms, massive front porch, stained glass front door. It never seemed strange to me as a child, but in my 20s, something happened to my dad's brother that caused him to never sleep in the house again. He had turned in for the night and was lying in bed with his back to the doorway when he felt his wife lie down beside and against him. A few moments later, his wife called him from the adjacent room to ask if he wanted a glass of water, and he knew then whatever was lying against him wasn't his wife. From that point, he would only stay in nearby hotels. My father and my aunt both teased him for being scared of his own home for many years, and I took this to mean that they thought he was being foolish for believing in ghosts or anything paranormal. About 15 years later, my aunt would set me straight on this point. My aunt and I were chatting in my kitchen one day, and she began to give me the house's history in strangeness. Things like slamming doors heard from outside when the house is empty. Shoulder taps if you're sitting by the window. Being woken in the night by what sounds like the ceiling rafters falling down. And even an apparition or two. A lady in white under the apple tree in the backyard. A man in olive green work clothes walking across the front porch. I had difficulty believing everything. After all, they'd given my uncle such a hard time. I asked both her and my father about this, and they said, no, weird stuff definitely goes on at the house. We weren't making fun of him because he believed in these things. We were making fun of him because he let it get to him. Over the years, I have come to understand that there's something odd about the whole property, not just that house. But that's another story. Anyway, after my grandmother died, my aunt moved into the house, and she eventually married a man I'll refer to as D. D was a special person, a mechanic and a man of varied interests you might call obsessions. Loved new wave music. He was a collector of the American Pickers variety and loved all things Americana, particularly old gas pumps and porcelain signs, mid-century modern decor, illuminated blow molds, records and stereos, Schwinn bicycles, vintage toys, particularly slot cars, Hot Wheels, and Star Wars, but essentially anything with clear value. He was also a sky watcher, had several expensive telescopes, and was committed to catching all astronomic events and rocket launches. As someone who watched the sky, he'd seen his share of UAPs and had also told me a few paranormal stories of his own. Having spent much of my life generally skeptical, again because I thought my father and aunt were, I had serious doubts about his stories. Sidebar,
I used to believe that if you were the type of person who has seen all manner of strangeness, maybe in fact, you're the source of the strange. Today, I'm more open to the possibility that some are either A, more sensitive to such things, or B, simply more observant. But one of his stories seemed particularly far-fetched to me. He said he was sitting by the window in the living room of grandmother's house. It was a day or so before a hurricane was supposed to hit us, and with that comes a low-grade sense of dread and expectancy, even as far inland as we are, which is between the Piedmont and coastal plains. But he said from the window, he saw what he described as a blacker-than-black dog with red, glowing eyes. He called it a hellhound in the retelling, and he was super casual when he told me about it. He said the hellhound looked at him and walked away, and he took this to mean that he'd be safe from the storm, and that it wasn't his time to die. I recall just smiling and nodding to this story. I mean, what do you say to that? Several summers later, my aunt was doing some garden work with the rest of my family and mentioned that Dee told her of a strange dream he had the previous night. He dreamt that he was in a kind of antique store filled with all the things he'd hunted for and collected throughout his life, and he felt an absolute euphoria in walking around the store. But then he found his departed father and his twin brother there, and the euphoria turned more to not fear, but wonder. He asked them if he died and if this was heaven. I think he awoke before they could answer. And when she told me the story, I jokingly asked if he needed to go see the doctor or if he was feeling okay. And she laughed and said that she'd asked him the same thing. Within a month, Dee died of a sudden heart attack. He'd been windsurfing in the Outer Banks and had suffered the attack while he was loading up his van to come home. While sad, this struck me as very poignant because his last moments were spent doing one of his favorite things in one of his favorite places. Shortly after his passing, I was with my aunt in her living room, and I just got the feeling that she was stressed about taking care of Dee's massive collection. I knew she'd want to liquidate most of it, and the thought of the hours spent cataloging and researching and then contacting potential buyers, etc., I felt this was weighing on her, so I told her I would help her process and sell everything. This had me spending much more time in and around my grandmother's house, and this is when I was able to experience the strangeness of the house firsthand. One rainy day, I'd ran some errands in town and had picked up a few scratch-off tickets for my aunt. When I entered the house, for whatever reason, the energy of the house felt different to me. I couldn't help but think of all the weird stories even before I knocked on the door. We sat down and were scratching the tickets, and she told me how much Dee would hate it when we buy lottery tickets. Despite being a collector, he was quite frugal. My aunt was scratching her ticket with an open pair of scissors. Nothing crazy, just a cheap pair you might cut construction paper with. She asked if she scratched off the numbers correctly, and when I saw she hadn't, I reached for the scissors on her knee. As soon as the underside of my thumb touched the metal, it felt almost like a spark hit me, like a very strong static electricity. I looked at my finger, and I had the smallest of cuts and had indeed drawn some blood. It would be as unlikely as laying your finger on the broadside of a butter knife and cutting yourself. Another day, I was helping her move Christmas decorations from Dee's shop out onto the front porch where we'd unbox and dust things before putting them up. My aunt went in the house for a second, and standing on the porch steps, from my peripheral vision, I could see the lower half of a man in work clothes sitting low on a chair. He was wearing gray pants and work boots. One leg was crossed over the other, and the man slumped very low in the chair, like you would if you were incredibly tired. That's how the posture struck me, tired, not relaxed. Of course, when I could look more fully upon the porch, it was no longer there. I didn't tell my aunt about this that day, but when I told my father, he didn't seem surprised.
In fact, he smiled, and I suddenly felt like I was part of the club now. One big day in our liquidating of his collection, my aunt and my father had readied some of Dee's cars to sell. He'd had a classic Mustang and a classic Camaro, among others, a GTI and a VW Bug. And my dad had brought them out of the shop and into the yard for the buyer to come see. The keys to Dee's cars were all in one key ring, which was a bad call in hindsight. Before the buyers could come by, somehow the keys went missing. My dad is not a careless person, and he couldn't believe he'd misplaced them. It was already a stressful day for my aunt. The selling of the vehicles was a big deal to her since they were the most valuable pieces of his collection. Now, the men wouldn't be able to start or drive the cars. My aunt and my father looked for hours, walking all over the yard and the house and the shop, but they couldn't find the keys. The buyers came and went. I got home from work, and Dad was catching me up on this as we rode to the pond when my aunt called him on the phone in tears. She'd found the keys, and they were somewhere weird. We returned to the house, and she gave us a hint to look under the hood of a specific car. I looked all around the engine in the car she indicated, and right before almost giving up, from a very odd angle, I could see the tip of a key somewhat poking out from underneath the engine or some car part. But to me, it would seem to defy physics for the keys to fall out of my dad's shirt pocket, not make a sound that he'd hear, and somehow land up under something and still lodge there. It was almost like an unseen hand would have needed to place it there. Another day, my aunt and I were sorting through dozens of plastic totes Dee kept all his collectibles stored in. Once again, my aunt had stepped out, this time to pick up lunch, and left me there sorting things alone. In a box, I found a vintage toy I didn't recognize. It was a wind-up toy that was mostly transparent plastic so you could see its inner workings, a bunch of plastic gears, and a kind of pump. The thing was like a robot with a top hat. If you turned the crank, it would kick its legs and swing its arms and chatter its jaw and whistle a bit. Of course, I didn't know this when I picked it up for the first time, but I did notice the turn key, and before I could fully form the thought in my mind, I wonder if this still works, it began to move its arms and legs right there in my hands. It was so instantaneous. It was as if I had made the thing work with my mind. But the weirder thing was my reaction. I wasn't freaked out or anything. I actually laughed out loud, which is a bit weird with no one around, maybe. It felt more like a joke or a trick to me. I set the thing down and it went on its way. I picked the thing up and the name of the toy was on its top hat, Mr. Machine. It didn't dawn on me then, but I was telling a friend this story, and she was like, "And you said Dee was a mechanic, right? Mr. Machine?" To that, I say it's easier to spot metaphors in other people's lives. Dee was careful of his stuff. He didn't leave batteries in things, for example, and he definitely wouldn't have cranked this toy up and then placed it into the box. By the way, you should YouTube Mr. Machine from Ideal Toys. Now, here's the coda. A friend of mine was helping me unearth the collectibles from a particular outbuilding we hadn't worked in yet. This friend of mine has also had some crazy experiences in his life, and I would describe him as being open and even sensitive to such things. Again, my aunt left us to work. Had something at church, I believe. I had told this friend everything about the house and wanted to give him the tour. I felt weird doing so with my aunt around. We'd been in the living room earlier, and my friend said, "Dean, I didn't get any weird vibes from that house at all." I agreed, and despite everything, I still don't tend to feel anything either. Still, I wanted him to see the rest of the house. There's a cluttered back room that is essentially storage for my aunt. I had reservations about showing it to him. Imagine a family member inviting someone to walk through your closet. But I took him in there anyway. We were only there for a few seconds when he said, "Dean,
I don't like this room. I said, yeah, pretty cluttered, pretty tight in here. He said, no, that ain't what I'm talking about. And then I was like, oh yeah, it does feel weird in here. And we left. Later that day, I was reporting to my aunt on all we did and all we found. I told her that I gave my friend a tour of the house, but I was still feeling a bit guilty about showing him the one room, so I left that off. I told her a bit of a half-truth then. I told her that my friend had said that he didn't get any weird feelings from the house despite his sensitivity. And she said, well, did you take him into the back room? The truth is out there, and we'll be right back to continue our search for it.
You know, there's something about a story like Dean's. A nice, quiet house, everyone's asleep, you're just settling in for the night.
Oh, and then an invisible being crawls into bed with you, and that switches things up a bit.
Yeah, that it does, unless you like that sort of thing. But but that's the feeling, is it's like, as the kids say, it's a mood, end of a long day, you just want to unwind. And for me, that's often a good glass of wine.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I like wine, but I never knew what to actually buy. Mm. I grab a box of something off the shelf and hope for the best. Then we found First Leaf, and folks, it just makes the whole thing easy.
Boy, it really does, and they really know what they're doing. I'm so glad we found them. And, you know, with First Leaf, you just answer a quick quiz about what you like, and then they match wines to your taste, and guess what? They send them right to your door. Couldn't be easier. Every box comes with tasting notes and pairing suggestions, so you actually know what you're pouring.
Yeah, this week I honestly got the perfect box from them. It had 6 amazing white wines in it, but my favorite was the Hawthorne Grove Limited Collection Chenin Blanc, bottled in 2023. Wow, this was a delicious wine. My wife, who actually wrote a movie called Wine Country, she loved this wine too.
Yeah.
But between that and the other 5 bottles from all over the world, including the Sir Oscar Darby from Australia, which was fun to have as well. I didn't personally know wine could taste this good. We really enjoyed it. And I actually took a picture of Biscuit the Cat, a boudoir shot of him with the wine bottles. I'm going to get that up on our socials.
What, wait, he was drinking wine?
No, but he does like the corks. But anyway, we've really enjoyed it. And with First Leaf, you can't beat the prices either.
Well, you really can't. And the reason you can't is because they work directly with wineries. So you're getting award-winning bottles. You know, this is stuff you can't find locally usually, and, you know, well below retail. So it's a win-win. And you control the schedule, so you can skip a month whenever, or, you know, if you're going on vacation, you can adjust for that. And if a bottle just misses, you know, it's not really on your palate, you know, there's a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
That's right. So stop settling for wines that don't quite hit the mark. Head to tryfirstleaf.com/DLO to sign up, and you'll get 50% off your first box plus free shipping for an entire year.
That's tryfirstleaf.com/DLO. Tryfirstleaf.com/DLO. Let's get back to unraveling this dead letter.
You know, we always go through these letters and we highlight things that we want to talk about. And there's a lot of things that I highlighted in this one. And you and I both kind of highlighted the same sections in some places here. Mm. If we go through them chronologically, the first one is actually, for me, the most chilling thing is the uncle who felt what he thought was his wife getting into bed next to him.
Yeah.
And then he hears his wife from the other, "You want some water, honey?" It's like, "No, thank you." And so that is like the definitely, I think, the really the spookiest thing. That, and we'll get to, you know, the last part of the story.
This is the Haunting on Hill House.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, there's a lot of things going on. But we just talked about that in the Shropshire story.
Yes.
In that things that are getting into bed with you. That seems to be a common thing they love to do. They love to get into bed with you. I think out of habit or just to freak you out, have a laugh, or genuinely freak you out, or find some kind of comfort on their end, as this may have happened. I tell this, I just got done telling that in the other DLO story, but it's one of my favorites just because when you see her on camera and how emotional, or just you can see she feels the story. Not that that makes any of it true, I realize, but that after her mom passed shortly, she felt a presence get into bed with her. Because I love the turn of phrase, it was pretending to be her mom, even though she didn't turn around. She felt the bed press down, something sidle up to her.
I'm not on board with the pretending. Let's not do pretending.
Well, neither was this guy. neither was the uncle. The other thing I love about that is that, yeah, they ribbed him pretty hard about that, but it wasn't because he believed in it, it's because he let it get to them. I love that attitude. You know, they know the house has got stuff going on that you just can't deny.
He would only stay in hotels after that. When he came to visit, he would not spend the night in the house.
Yeah, that's a lot of money to avoid
that's
that.
That's a commitment.
But that freaked him out so bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
So badly that he couldn't do that. And what an inconvenience. but I get it. It's just that's part of what we're talking about here is that the personal experience is so intimate and invasive in a way, and so shocking and upsetting that it sticks with you the rest of your life.
I had a kind of a sobering feeling about this story, and I'm going to tell you why. It actually got me to thinking about my own mortality because, you know, I don't feel like I'm that old. I'm not going to quote my age on the air here, but like I really have a lot in common with this guy named D here, who eventually came into the scene, the mechanic, loved new wave music, all of these collector of American Pickers variety, all of this kind of stuff. And I was like, wow, I have a lot in common with this person. Like,
you do,
is this a Gen X guy?
He's of that. He's of that era, especially the items that he collected and the toy.
Yeah, and windsurfing. I used to windsurf. He passed away after a windsurfing day in the Outer Banks, my state. Yeah. I'm like, what is this? Am I looking into my future? It's like sometimes when my wife and I are having a really bad day, we're somewhere like a bunch of things have gone wrong. And there'll be a quiet moment, and she'll just look over at me and go, "Are we dead?"
That's a little bit
how I felt when I was reading this particular dead letter. I was like, wait, why do I have so much in common with D? Here?
Except I would say that you are the opposite of a picker and or collector.
I'm not in my heart. I want to be that person.
I know. And the reason you give, which I understand and agree with, is because you've moved so often. You don't want to have
And I used to have and collect a lot more things, but I'm telling you what, a couple of cross-country moves will make you throw shit away.
Yeah.
Right. I miss some of the things I used to collect. Yeah. I do, you know.
Well, it's also having the space. But interviewed,
I just don't want to deal with it anymore. And also in that mortality thing, I'm thinking about my 16-year-old. It's like I don't want him to have to deal with my crap either. So I'm trying.
I'll let him deal with it. We all have to. He's got enough on his plate.
Yeah.
That's something you know that happens to you in your 50s and 60s. So
yeah.
I would say collect it, but know what's important. And here, old toys. I wish I had a lot of the old toys I had when I was a kid. Not only because, they're worth hundreds of dollars now. But I remember one that I had a kid, speaking of robots. Now, this is different because I do remember this toy, Mr. Machine.
I remember it too. I didn't have it, but I remember it from my being around, maybe other kids had it, or I saw it at some preschool or something. I do remember this toy. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember any of that, but it's like an item that you would find in one of those cool, really hip toy stores.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's one of those. You know where there is one of those? In no one. If we hear from anybody that's been to this place, I'll be amazed. But in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on the Delaware River, just across from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, there is a little toy store, which I hope is still there. And it's nothing but these kinds of toys in it. Like 50s and 60s toys and little robots and stuff. It's the best store ever.
Yeah, like they're vintage.
Lots of fun.
The thing is, you already owned it. It was gifted to you. I got this walking robot when I was a kid, and cost of having to buy back your childhood is immense.
Yes, it is.
Where you already owned it and it was tossed out years ago. But this thing, it was cool, but it also creeped me out a little bit in a very good way. But it was, I think it was called, it was the television robot. So that was made by Horikawa.
Yes.
In the 60s and 70s. And I had to look this up because I didn't remember since I was a kid.
I looked it up when you mentioned it to me right before we were about to record. And by the way, I completely agree that this thing is spooky. Because
it is,
is like a face on a television screen inside a helmet.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's what I wondered as a kid because it was so cool. Here's this toy briefly because if this thing came on, it has an innate freaky factor to it, it would be even more creepy. This was it was like a black robot. And what Scott's describing is that there's a robot head on it, but there's a windscreen or like a little windshield, a face visor. And inside, this was what I couldn't understand as a kid, is that there's a human man's face inside.
Right.
But the midsection, the main part of the body, was like a television screen. And what this thing did was that it had a loop of a slideshow, right? Kind of like the not 3D. Yeah. It was just like a rolling, scrolling loop of space scenes that
like inside a Goodyear blimp toy. Kind of.
Yeah, it's right. So yeah. it would rotate yeah. and it was lighted. So as it yeah. walked, this thing would scroll different pictures of outer space. You have to remember too, 60s, 70s, space was everything because yeah,
space
of
age stuff. All the cars yeah. had fins because of rockets, all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. It was the space yeah. age, all the Apollo landings that I remember as a kid even. And so that's it was cool. all the, a lot of toys were themed that. And if this thing came alive, yeah, just because like, you know, I was thinking like, how was a human man's head inside the robot head? Is it just like a severed head that's connected to, that they're keeping alive?
I mean, there's lots of different ones here. I see one somewhere. It looks like maybe it's on a TV screen. So maybe this is like an early attempt to say, no, what you do is you're somewhere else and you, it's like an avatar for you and you right. control it remotely. And that's your face is on the screen. So, which is dumb because if you're seeing the face, that doesn't mean the face is seeing the world that the robot's in. It's just a face.
Well,
on
could
the screen.
It would have,
but there's other
cameras.
Ones that are, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cool. It's very creepy. There's a reason that Spielberg had those things all going crazy in that scene when the little boy got abducted in Close Encounters. All the toys went crazy when the UFO showed up, and it was a bunch of little toys like this, a little newer than this, but still. And the monkey with the symbols, which I have one. I bought one of those off eBay. It was $600.
Ooh.
But it's brand new, and it works. Yeah. You put the batteries in it, and it claps the symbols and everything. And that was a couple years ago.
Don't toss that out in the Goodwill bin. But the point about all this is that there is, and I'm going to make a point, I swear, I'm wrapping this around, is that there is an expenditure of energy when it comes to a lot of ghost experiences people believe, right? That there's an interaction and an interchange of energy, and that may light up some toys. And how much of a common trope is it that spirits can apparently control electronic items, and especially toys? One I just heard of, I can't remember. Oh, this might have been just an Instagram reel of a beloved father passing away. I think one of the daughters with the family there, like, show us a sign that you're still around, Dad. And this toy fire engine lights up. Well, he had been a firefighter in his living life. And that's the object he chose to turn on.
Yeah.
And my point here is that with these kind of hauntings and residual energy experiences, electricity is one thing that seems to be manipulated for effect and messaging. Yeah, the Horikawa Space Explorer robot, also known as TV Robot. So that thing is, Mr. Machine, though, is just mechanical. The fact that you could say like, well, it was wound up, and when you picked it up, it released a mechanism or got unstuck and it just started walking. Well, possibly, but also I think toys, again, I'd say are manipulated by spirit for other reasons as a way of communication. And look at me, I'm talking to you. And but scrolling back, some of the other things that happened in the first part of the story here, Mr. D also had UAP experiences, but the other stuff kind of freaked him out too, in that, he was a sky watcher. He'd had several experiences. Some of this is all kind of connected. He had other paranormal stories of his own. I wish we had those to tell. But also I love our author here has, as he says, spent much of his life generally skeptical. And he thought his father and aunt were, but no, they were teasing him because he didn't fully accept, the uncle didn't fully accept what was happening around him.
Yeah.
But I love the open-mindedness of our author here. But the other thing I was talking about with energies expended, and ghost hunters will often tell you, you'll get a lot more activity if there's a thunderstorm around, because you have a release of, there's ionization, ozone, there's all these effects, low barometric pressure. Also, that can affect your vision. I think when there's low pressure, things appear closer. I may have that flipped. It's one of those two. It's one or the other. Either things appear further away or closer when there's a change in the weather. And this is the day before a hurricane. And as he says here, I'm going to reread this, that comes with a kind of low-grade sense of dread and expectancy, even though you're far inland, as you said at the opening here, is that you sense like you're further away, or it seems the ocean's further away, but you're going to get hit with it just as well.
And that's something I wanted to talk about. We had a guest on the show some time ago. We did an episode called The White Horse of Greensboro, which is where I live, or The Phantom Horse of Greensboro, excuse me. our friend and a graphic artist who designed our logo, Tommy Beaver, came on the show and told that story. But he's got a lot of really good local stories. He's been in North Carolina pretty much his whole life and is a great storyteller. And one of the stories that he had told me some time ago, and I recorded, we were in a restaurant or something, and I recorded it. And I don't think it's ever aired anywhere, even in a junk drawer, but is about some family that he had that had some land near where he's from, which I think this took place in Moxville, North Carolina. But they would sometimes look out the window and see this large white dog running across a field.
Yeah.
Everyone knew everybody. Everyone had lived there for generations, but no one knew who this dog belonged to. But whenever they saw it, they knew a storm was coming.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that would be the only time they would see it. So I thought that was pretty neat. But in this case, that was a white dog. It's not as ominous as a black dog and fits into all the black dog folklore with the black shuck and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the other thing that North Carolina has is, you know, the Beast of Bloddenboro, which is down at the beach.
Right.
People have seen that on the beach, which ironically, Tommy's son, who is a college graduate, older now in his 20s, saw with his girlfriend at some point.
Yeah.
So I was going to have them on about that. I can't believe we haven't interviewed them.
Yeah, I know. We got so many stories to get to.
There's a lot of lore here, which I think probably is pervasive in the South as well, which of course has connections to folklore from the Appalachian region and immigrants coming across the pond, you know, Scottish and Irish immigrants back in the day, bringing these stories with them, and English as well. A lot of those stories came with them, but I've heard multiple stories like that. But the only firsthand one I've heard is, and it's Tommy saying this about his own family, so that's 2 degrees away. But it's interesting to hear that and not see it just in a book. And I think it's interesting here. The other thing that was really fascinating, you pointed this out when we were prepping this episode, was that in this particular case, they took it to mean that they would be safe in the storm as opposed to in trouble.
It's not a bad omen of impending doom or harm. It's like you're okay.
It's a happy hellhound. Yeah. It's like you look at the hellhound, it looks at you and it raises its paw and a little thumbs up. It's like, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay, dude.
The dew claw raising. It's one of those things that's how you take it. Again, it's just another theme of this story here, this collection of anecdotes. It depends on how you receive these things, and you can be scared or you can be teased. Not that you have to like believe everything. It's just that like, no, that happened. Don't be afraid of it. That's part of life in a way. You know what I'm saying? Like that kind of attitude is like, these things happen. And I like the idea here that is the hellhound. It's not like it's causing something bad to about to happen. It may be a warning that something's coming or a protector from something that's coming.
Right.
And or as Danny Aiello says in Jacob's Ladder, it's like the demons you think are chasing you may actually be angels trying to help you.
Oh, I got to put Jacob's Ladder down on my list for my
Sunday
watch.
I'm halfway through rewatching. I have not seen that in years.
Oh,
but yeah,
spooky.
That's the idea, is that a lot of it's how you take this and how you react to it is how it'll be affected by you. And you, right, had just mentioned the Phantom Horse of Greensboro. Yeah. And around the time that we did that episode, in fact, it happened just before, because I do believe I told this anecdote in the episode, something odd had also happened to me in the middle of the night, where around that time, I think it was hot out. You know, being in Los Angeles and having a very old apartment I was living in that was adjacent to the street, and the street corner, the intersection here, was like one apartment building away. So I could see the street and kind of the corner there. And how that's relevant is that I awoke one hot LA night where you're kind of half sleeping to this enormous clattering sound. And the only way I could describe it at the time was it was a metallic clattering, like 50 shopping carts all chained together being dragged down the street and just tumbling over each other. It's like, this very strange sound, like it, you know, again, half asleep or trying to get to sleep because it's so hot. And I sat up in bed and keeping the window open, I could see right out onto the street. Like, the hell is that? Like, what? You know, we had a lot of shenanigans from various folks that roamed the streets, you could say, at all hours.
Yes.
And it's like, is somebody doing, you know, somebody, some kind of vandalism going on? Like, what's going on? And, you know, somebody driving or pushing a bunch of shopping carts down the street in a car. Mm-hmm. Anything could happen in LA. Like, it could be any kind of weirdness.
Yeah.
Not like Manhattan weirdness, but like LA has its own brand of weirdness. It's like, who's doing what? It's just like, again, like somebody with 50 Hollywood bed frames, like just dragging those down the pavement. It's like, what? So I sat up in bed and I was now intently like looking out the window because the way it sounded was that this thing was coming down the side street and going to come around the bend to my street, which is a more major street. And I was waiting to see something. And then suddenly the noise stopped. And what came around that corner and running more towards my apartment and down the street that my apartment faced was this enormous white dog.
All right.
Of what breed I could not make out. It was like a cross between like an albino German Shepherd and a, it had that kind of shape to it, you know, pointy snout, but big. I mean, not dire wolf big, but like, you know, 120 pound dog, like a big dog. And he comes running down the street, makes the corner and just continues on up the street, running at a high pace of speed. And I'm like, what is, because look, there's a lot of people walking their dogs, right? But not at 3 a.m. usually. And maybe the dog had gotten away.
I think you have overlooked some of the most famous advice of all time.
Yeah.
And this is what you needed to take into account in this scenario, which is, if you can't run with the big dogs, stay on the porch.
Well, I stayed in my bedroom. I did not go outside. I was tempted to go see what was down the street and was like, oh, okay, that's weird enough for tonight. Plus, I needed to get to sleep. I don't know if it was the night before the recording. It may have been. I can't remember, but I told
maybe you had like one of my exploding head syndrome things where you got awakened by a weird noise that was not present in the real world but preceded the dog. Maybe you would have never seen the dog had you not been awakened by the metal cart sounds. Maybe that was some sort of psychological premonition.
Possibly initially, but here's the thing. Again, I wasn't fully asleep, but I sat up in bed and the noise was still going on. You know what I'm saying? Like it was a long, it wasn't like a big crash.
Okay.
Like I said, it wasn't like somebody dropped 50 shopping carts at once from a high, you know, from 20 feet. Yeah. It was a continuing sound. That's what eventually woke me up. Like it kept going on.
I think another thing that's really fascinating here and touching, it's kind of heartwarming in a way, is the dream that Dee had about, you know, being in the antique store and the euphoria and then also finding his departed father and twin brother. And
yeah,
that's like a really amazing experience. And to have that precede his death by about a month.
Yeah.
The death which I mentioned a minute ago was like after a full day of windsurfing in the Outer Banks, which is one of the best windsurfing spots in the world,
by the way.
Mm-hmm. And yes, I used to windsurf when I was younger. I never was good enough to go to the Outer Banks. I windsurfed in much tamer conditions, but I sure did love it. It was a lot of fun. But had the heart attack while putting the board away on his van, which is a lot of work, by the way, disassembling those things.
No.
It's harder than the actual windsurfing, depending on how big the board is.
Right.
But, so I actually can understand this entire scenario, but it's interesting what Dean says, who is our letter writer, about it being poignant because, quote, his last moments were spent doing one of his favorite things in one of his favorite places.
Right.
I was pretty touched by that, honestly.
I'm going to chalk that experience up, the dream, to a version of what hospice nurses and you know, doctors will call visioning. And there's a great clip from hospice nurse Julie. If anyone has contact with her.
Forrest really wants us to interview her. But she's hard.
Yeah,
to get
just be, I know she's blown up. But just because I like her attitude of being rational, but also open to what she's seen with her own eyes and experience. Mm-hmm. Having been a nurse, a hospice nurse, I think for at least 30 years now, but also you know, with a scientific mind, not just chalking it up to like, well, you know, that's just deprivation of oxygen. Mm-hmm. And what visioning is when people are about, you know, they're in the final dying phase, about 2 weeks out or so, they will start seeing relatives and loved ones show up and not while asleep, but like in the room, it's like with my own great grandmother, she said, Uncle Judd was just here. And she said, well, Grandma, you know, he's been dead for like 30 years. And she goes, I know.
Yeah.
And so they're aware of what's happening because I know, but he was here. He said, everything's going to be fine. And we're all waiting for you. And we're going to guide you on to a much better place. That's visioning and reaching out. Sometimes you'll see people in hospice, like reach out to something that's not there. Like they're trying to touch someone or hold someone's hand that's in the room that no one else can see. And so there's different versions of this kind of visioning, and sometimes it's a dream. And I think without this guy knowing it, because certainly he didn't sound sick, but he had a heart attack brewing underneath, is that it's a way of making their appearance known and that we're here for you and we're waiting and it'll all be fine because, again, not fear, as he says, but wonder. And he asked them if he died and if this was heaven. And that's a version of heaven for him, being in a kind of antique store. And it's all the things that you've been looking for all your life and wanted to collect. And they're all in one place. And not only that, your father.
And your previously deceased loved ones.
Yeah, your father yes. and your twin brother are there waiting for you to have some fun. Yeah. And what a great dream. And just like, yeah, as he says, absolute euphoria. That's what I take that as, as a kind of precognitive dream of sorts, or your subconscious signaling that get ready, this is coming. But but also not sad because, well, it's sad that he passes, but also, as you said, poignant because he's doing the favorite things. And and there's another a contact from D here in that the scissors and that, like, again, maybe not intending to put a little cut, a little paper cut on our author here, but like, hey, what are you doing wasting your money with scratchers? Like, you should be wasting your money on old wooden Indians at from drugstores and old gas pumps and half barrels, planters, you know, like that was what he found worth in and was just kind of expressing his annoyance. But like, it may not be where he just ghostly reaches out and tries to shock somebody, but just that feeling, that emotion triggered that reaction.
Yeah, and then he saw an apparition as well. Yeah. So that's another thing that's pretty amazing. And like this perception of the apparition, but then it's like when he told his dad about it, and I'm talking about Dean here,
right?
Not D, but he had seen that. And when he told his dad about the apparition, he said his dad wasn't surprised, but he had smiled. And Dean felt like he was part of the club now that has experienced something at the house. It's a cool thing. The knowing, you know, it's like the Miyagi look at the end of the fight when Miyagi's when Daniel wins the fight.
Yes. You understand now.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, what do you think about the keys anecdote here about those going missing? Because what I want to ask is, do you think that the spirit, the ghost of D was like, I'm not ready to part with these things and hides the keys?
Or maybe he's trying to go for a drive.
The thing though, that's not explained in the story here that I wanted to know is that the aunt that says, she calls up though, and she's in tears.
Yeah.
What happened there where she found
something
out where the keys were?
Yeah. That's not explained, but something about how she found them or the circumstances clearly connected with her in a way, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's what's behind that.
I think that was the impression
I got. In the other realm of things left unanswered, like how did the aunt find the keys and why was that upsetting to her? The next question is, what happened in the back room that the sensitive person was not into and also led Dean's aunt to say, well, did you take him into the back room? Because that's not good. What's going on in there? There's a bunch of junk in there. Maybe that junk has some significance. Maybe I wonder what object or item or specific issue is going on with some of the things in that room that seems to have a negative feeling of some kind.
Yeah.
But we need more history on that. So I would say, Dean, you need to tell us what happened there. Can we get some information on that?
Once again, we're left with a cliffhanger as the aunt says, well, did you take him into the back room? It's like, what happened in the back room? Or what does the aunt feel like? And what does she sense there? Because there's a bunch of things wrapped up in this house and they each occupy their own little areas.
Yeah.
And now you've added Mr. D to the mix and Mr. Machine.
Yeah.
Which just kind of comes alive at will. But it's just, I would love to visit the house and do a
I would too. And that's actually theoretically possible for me if this house is still in the family. There you go, Dean. Send me the address and I'll go check it out. Right. I probably pass it on my way to the beach frequently.
you don't even know. But that's that game, you know, not the red card, blue card, but it's like haunted, not haunted. The houses that you drive
to make
by.
An ancient reference. And I don't even, I barely remember this myself, but because my wife is a comedy writer and is a student of comedy on TV for many decades going back, I think of one of her favorite episodes of Laverne and Shirley, where they get in a fight and they put a piece of tape down the middle of the apartment so that one half belongs to Laverne and the other half belongs to Shirley. That's what you need to do in this house. I think you need to put some tape down and just be like, all right, you're staying in there. You're staying over here.
Right.
Thing that crawls in the bed. You stay in the back room. You know, that's
here's my point about sometimes things spilling over. that actually happened with a good friend of mine. They were two grades earlier than me in high school, but they went on to college. Two of our good friends, they ended up as dorm roommates. And the one roommate, a very awesome guy, but he was pretty messy. And his and the other friend's pretty neat. So finally he just put duct tape down the center of the dorm room.
Okay.
But the messy guy, he, case in point, he dropped a box of laundry detergent on the floor and the pile of powder spilled over the tape onto the clean side. It's like sometimes you can't contain these things. So his mess was so grandiose, it just spilled over. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've had
maybe we've
like
got
that,
the spiritual equivalent of that here in this house.
The connection I'll make to the story is about perception. You don't see it. It's like that's just perception. And, you know, like I said, these things are happening. And until you go into that back room or until you sleep in the house and something crawls into bed with you, then it makes an impact. Then it has your attention. And I think sometimes that's the point of the action. Is to, hey, you got to snap out of this living human sack of meat. Pay attention.
Well, Dean, we had a lot of fun reading this story. Thank you so much for trusting us with something this personal and as personal to your family. And again, send me an invite. I'll come over and check it out. I wouldn't mind seeing what's in that back room too. And if you get any more answers on some of our questions, we'd love to have those too. In the meanwhile, thank you for sending your letter into the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bolton. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.